From the outskirts of the greatest territory in wrestling history, Memphis, Tennessee, it's Wrestling Talk with Mayor McCall, and I'm your co-host, Willie B. As always, I'm joined by my tag team partner. He is the founder, promoter, and CEO of this podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, the Booker of the Stars, Mayor McCall.
Willie B., we have a very, very special guest with us today. He is a true wrestling icon and legend known to fans all over the globe. He is a former WWF Tag Team Champion, former Intercontinental Champion. He was the Mountie in the WWF, and we all know that the Mountie always gets his man. Ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Jacques Rougeau.
Yay, what an entry. Hi, guys, how you doing?
Doing well, Jacques. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Brings me back good some memories when you talk about Memphis.
So, yeah, well, tell us a little about your Memphis days. How did you, what years were you here?
I think I was there, well, I was hoping you'd refresh my memory.
Well, we have it on here that we know that you're a two-time Southern Heavyweight Champion, which is a very big deal around here. I know you won it around 1981, so the first time. So you were here in the early 80s, I guess before your the WWF career and your brother.
Yeah, that was about the time there where I'm trying to think of Jerry Lawler and Dundee and Jimmy Hart and the Fabulous Ones. And,
yes.
Oh, speaking of the Fabulous Ones, I talked to Steve Kern for a while this morning, and he told me that you used to live with him and Stan in Hendersonville, Tennessee.
What a great guy. What a wonderful guy all around. I love Steve. I'm actually still Facebook friends with him, like 40 years later.
Wow.
And so yeah, what a great guy. And there's a lot of guys that I remember that were really nice to. I don't know if you remember, what was his name? Carl Fergie. Remember him?
Absolutely. I've had some contact with Carl. I'm trying to get him to do the podcast with us, a Memphis wrestling legend.
What a great guy. I'm still in touch also with Coco Beware.
Yes, we interviewed him. We interviewed him.
He was actually our last guest.
Really? You should have told me. I would have gave you a good story on him.
Hey, feel free. Now's the time.
Yeah, we would love a good story with Coco. He was phenomenal.
But I want to, before we get into all that, I want to back up a little bit for the fans. How did it come about you got into the wrestling business?
Well, Jesus, we're four generations of wrestling in the Rougeau family. So I was born by the pool, and Abdullah the Butcher and Joe LeDuc used to come and see my dad and my uncle to go over the finishes of the night. The following night there at the big event. So I was brought up around wrestling all my life. I was like 3 years old going to see my dad wrestle and my uncle, my great uncle. And so it was just a family thing.
Was it in fact your father who trained you to be a wrestler?
My father trained me a bit, but my brother Raymond trained me a lot with Pierre, Matt, Doug LeFevre. Those were the guys that I really trained with a lot. And then after that, it was just off to my first territory in 77 for Stu Hart, Bret Hart's dad, and Calgary Stampede Wrestling. And then went on to my second territory was for Nick Goulas in 78 in Nashville. And with Dutch Mantel and all those guys, Randy Savage was Randy Poffo and Angelo Poffo and Gypsy Joe and those guys there that... George and Goulas actually was there too at the time. What was his name too? A really nice guy, Bobby Eaton. What a great guy!
Beautiful Bobby.
Just a fantastic person all around.
Yeah, one of my favorite all-time wrestlers. Worker.
Me too, and me too. What a great guy to go in the ring with and give him your body. He's a guy who always took care of you and. Made you look good, very unselfish, and always a pleasure to work with Bobby.
Yeah, Bobby, we've had Jamie Dundee on the show, and that was Jamie was Bobby's brother-in-law. Of course, Bobby, if people don't know, Bobby was married to the superstar Bill Dundee's daughter.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, married to Donna. They were married for 40 years or so, yeah.
What was it like working for Stu Hart?
It was wonderful. You know, Stu Hart... It was a nice territory. Do a lot of traveling though by bus, and but working Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, And but it was a great experience up there because it was almost making love to the first girlfriend. It was my first territory, so it was like for me it was like just discovering the business with the boys and going. They were such a great family and a nice family too. They'd have me over for dinner every Sunday because I was very young. I was 17 years old, so it was like a puppy, and I was staying at the St. Regis Hotel, which was downtown Calgary, where the Indians and the whores were on 7th Avenue. So it was a rough place for me to be alone there. So they'd come and get me on Sunday, our only day off, and they'd bring me up the hill in the house and with the 15 kids and the 1,000 cats in the house. It was amazing, though. They were very kind.
The legendary Hart House. I've seen so many documentaries and it's just wild. All the stories you hear, you hear about the cats and the kids and everything, and all the wrestlers, and it's just that's pretty amazing. Did your father, since you're you know, I guess would you be second, third generation wrestler? What did your father did he know Stu Hart? Did they have a history together?
Nope, not at all.
Not at all. Okay.
Not at all. Actually, with the Harts, not at all. The Harts were in the West, and the Rougeaus were in the East of Canada, and actually, it's so funny because when I went to work for Stu Hart, I'll never forget the first conversation I had with him. I called him up, and I was 17 years old. I was like very skinny. I was like 165 pounds, but very athletic, so I called Stu, and my father had told me that I wasn't ready to go on the road yet, so I borrowed $500 from my mom, and I called Stu behind my father's back, and I got Stu on the line, and that'll be a classic conversation for the rest of my life, because I remember the first time I talked to Stu, I was saying, how you doing, Mr. Hart? My name is Jimmy Rougeau, and I'd like to come and wrestle for you. And he answered me, said, are you any kin with the Rougeau family there? And I said, yes. I said, my Uncle Johnny and my dad Josh says, I said, yes, I am. He says, You know, your father's a pretty tough guy there, you know, and that was my first conversation I had with him.
did you ever get stretched out in the dungeon?
No way, Jose. Every time he had plans for I unfortunately had other business that I couldn't make it to the dungeon downstairs. I kind of stayed away from there. I heard the reputation, and I knew the guys were telling me, whatever you do, is he's going to invite you to dinner, and then he's going to invite you downstairs, but don't go downstairs. And me being an artiste, of course, not being a real fighter in life, just being an entertainer, I kind of stayed away from the dungeon there.
That's great right there. We've already kind of jumped ahead and alluded to a little bit. So, you know, speaking of your Memphis days, you know, in the CWA, what are some of your memories in working with Jerry Jarrett?
You know what? I really like that man, Jerry Jarrett, and I'm actually very, very close friends with Double J. Actually, he's going to be part of my wrestling academy this year as a judge. But we'll get back to that later. But his father was such a nice person, and he took a liking in me, and so I had some good times there. Won a few belts, it was very. And Jerry Lawler too was. He took a liking in me. He liked me from that day. I was traveling in the car one time, and I told him. I said, how come I don't have music going to the ring? Like, you know, I said, and then Jerry Lawler told me, it's only the main events that have music to go to the ring, you know, and I answered him back at the time pretty cocky. I told him, I said, why are you a bigger boy? Are you afraid I'm going to get over more than you? And he kind of liked that. He thought it was arrogant, and he liked that. And so I came in with a big jukebox on my shoulder there, and
the big boom box.
And I started playing Dirty Laundry going to the ring there, And so that's how I got my music going to the ring, and that got over, and he finally gave me the belt. And so you know, sometimes they say you're lucky, sometimes they say you make your own luck in this business, you know. So, and but very nice people. Pretty much everybody was very, very nice to me.
And Lance Russell would look at you and be like, Jacques, it's time to cut off the music. We need to do the interview now. We can cut the boombox off now, Jacques.
What a great announcer, Lance Russell. You know, what great times I had with him. What a classic voice. What a him and Les Thatcher, I think, that was working with him at the time.
Dave Brown.
Okay, so where did I meet Les Thatcher down south? Les Thatcher, he was announcing at one of the territories that I went. But anyway, long story short, there's a... Lance Russell, what a great announcer, and I could see him. As a matter of fact, I saw a video not too long ago when Dutch Mantel came out, and there was a Coco Beware, and there was Bobby Eaton, Coco Beware, actually, and I was tagging up with Terry Taylor to meet, and Lance Russell was doing the promo there when I was out, and there was he had such a distinguished voice and so calm, like, well, okay now, Jacques, and I just like the way Lance Russell talks. You know, he was very convincing and very professional.
We always say around here that Lance and Dave, especially, you know, Dave Brown was our local weatherman, and Lance was the local TV. He was the local TV director. That they brought a level of, and I hate to use this word, but it's true. They brought a level of legitimacy to the product on TV. They were your every week hosts. And they were, you know, when you saw them, you knew it was show, and they treated it and sold it to you like it was the, you know, it was a shoot. Like you felt it was real.
It was credible.
Correct. They it was credible. Yes. And it was, you know,
very
we.
Credible. Yeah.
In 83, you would. In 83, for like the second time, you'd win the AWA Southern Heavyweight title from Terry Taylor. What was it like working with Terry?
Well, you know, it was really, Terry was a good worker, you know, and all the girls loved him. So when I turned heel, it was like, it was fun because I was a tag team partner, and I turned on him, and we had a feud, and there was not one girl in the place that didn't love Terry, so... So it was easy, and he was a good seller too. He was a great, great seller. So it was very easy to get heat on Terry and get some heat with the people. And so it was fun. And those are the good days.
Now this makes sense though, because you said Terry was over with the ladies. So I saw one promo, and you said Dutch Mantel was Terry Taylor's wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah, Dutch Mantel. What a storyteller that man is.
Yeah, the look on Lance Russell's face when you're like, yeah, bring your wife Dutch Mantel out here, Terry.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I remember that. That's right, I remember I said that. That's right, I remember that. That's funny. That was very funny. And, it was a territory where you drive a lot, though. You know, if I'm not mistaken, we'd go to Tupelo, Mississippi. We'd go to Louisville, Kentucky, Evansville, Indiana.
Yep.
We were all over the place. I'm trying to think. We went to Nashville, I believe, and so we had some long drives out of Memphis. But you know, when you with a bunch of guys that are fun with to travel with, it makes it easier at the time.
Speaking of driving, when I was talking to Steve this morning, Steve Curran was like, John, you remember the Dusters? I was like, yes, sir. He said, Jacques had a Duster.
Holy shit. Yeah, holy shit. This is
he
awesome.
Was telling me about the hood scoop and everything on the Duster.
Hey, man, I had it down like a black man. My car had fur on the roof and had fur behind my mirror. I had lights, red lights under the dash and under the car.
He said you had balls hanging down from the ceiling. You were all decked out.
Man, I had a jacked up, listen, my car was jacked up in the back. I had a spoiler in the back. I got a hood in the front there, a hoodie, like you said there, a scoop, a spoiler, and I had the arch in the back, and my car looked like a race drag car, a killer car, but only had a 6 engine in it. It was so funny. because I get on the corner of the streets and the guys would come beside me that have like Mustangs and Corvettes, and they'd come in right beside me and they'd look at me and I'd look at them and they'd go, and I'd look at them and I'd go, and, you know, with my little car, and then they'd take off real fast. I'd never race. I just had the look. That's all I had, you know. But it was funny. The funniest thing about that car is when I came back to Montreal. Holy shit! I came back to Montreal, and I'll tell you a funny story. I got to tell you one funny story with that car. Now that
please.
You bring it up, I got my Uncle Johnny, who's the right hand man of René Lévesque, who's the Prime Minister of Quebec. It's like
Governor
Donald Trump, you know, in the
States. Yeah.
So he's Prime Minister in Quebec. So, but my father, my Uncle Johnny, he's his right-hand man. So they're in the election time, and my uncle's supposed to go pick him up to bring him to the polls the night of the voting and stuff. So something happened. My Uncle Johnny couldn't make it, so he calls my dad up, and we live about 20 miles out of Montreal in the suburbs, and he calls my dad up. He says, Jacques, he says, because my dad's Jacques too, so he says, Jacques, he says, can you come and pick up René at l'Hôtel de Ville, which is the mayor, you know, the mayor's house there? How do you call that, Hôtel de Ville? The city council. So he says, can you come up and pick up René Lévesque at the city council and bring him to the poll on the South Shore, Montreal? So my dad says, sure, yes. So it just so happened that my father's car, he went to start it and didn't work. So I offered to take my car. And so when I got into town, I went to pick up the Prime Minister of Quebec with my furry hair car, you know, in the room, golden fur inside. And then, listen, it's so funny because when the Prime Minister came out of the house of he looked at the car, and he had no other ride to get there. So he sat down, and he was bald headed. So when he sat in my car, he now had like full of hair on his head because I had the long, long fur on the roof there, you know. And it was just so funny to see René Lévesque sitting in a black man's car, like, you know, and going on the South Shore to the polls there. So when we got to the polls, and it's so funny because the next day my Uncle Johnny called my father and he gave him shit. He says, what the hell did you do? Like, you know, and it was just so funny. I had the fog lights in front of the car. You can't imagine the gimmicks I had on my car. I swear to God, I'd just come from Atlanta, Georgia, and it was just it was just a trip for me, a thrill for me. But it was funny because he got in the car anyway, and he came. The Prime Minister got in my funny looking car.
The Prime Minister got to go vote in style. There's no doubt about that.
Hey man, you know. The Mountie always gets his man.
Exactly.
The Mountie always gets his man.
Exactly.
The Mountie always gets the Prime Minister in the duster.
That's right.
That could be possibly one of the greatest stories ever told on this podcast. Jacques Rougeau and the famous duster.
Well, let's just put it this way. I didn't get his vote.
We're sorry it didn't go your way, Jacques. Well, you know, we've talked about you've had some wonderful memories and times in, you know, CWA, Memphis territory. How did it end up you would go to the WWF?
Well, it was just simple. We all know the story. Vince trying to kill every territory that existed, so he went to get all the best wrestlers of every territory, and we were lucky. I was lucky to be chosen by Vince. Actually, a year before Raymond and I were chosen, I was scouted out by Pat Patterson, who I was working for the Fullers in Pensacola for a couple of years now, and going back to Montreal in the summer and going back to Robert Fuller because he was a very, very close friend of mine, and he used me very well with Joe LeDuc. We did some good angles there and stuff, and I was getting now at pretty much the prime of my career now as far as being at my best in 84, 85. I was 24, 25 years old, 240. I looked good, blonde, brownish hair, and a nice tan, nice shape. And I was very athletic in the ring, and Pat Patterson had an eye on me, not only personally, but business-wise. And but long story short is he had an eye for my work, and so he started calling me in Pensacola. And then, and so I went, and I was in this... I was having a little argument with Dino Bravo in Montreal because he had the territory here, and I didn't like the way he was treating me. And because I was going up the ladder and trying to make it up to the top, and he was trying to put himself on top, it was his business, which I understand. When you're the owner of your business, it's like the same thing as Jerry Lawler was doing in Memphis.
Yep.
You know, he was taking all the guys from around the world, putting himself over, and then and it works like that. But it's for me to take it or leave it. And I was a young pup, cocky, and I wanted to go somewhere, so I didn't want to come in second, so I just didn't like the position I had. So I just left the business here in Montreal, and I went to work down south. And so when Pat Patterson heard that there was a disaccord there, like a problem between me and Dano, and Dino, so he just took the advantage and he called me up and he says, hey, WWF is going into Montreal for their first show. And he says, we'd like to put you main event, Jock, against Samu. And I said, hey, I said, sounds good to me. I said, it'll make Dino appreciate me a little more. You know, so that worked well. And then I went in. I did the shot and the sold out house, and I stole the show because I was a hometown boy coming home. And with the WWF, that made a name for themselves just actually not being there, but it was the first time. So, but they had a reputation out. So when I came in and did the main event and won the match at the end, well, all my fans were there from many, many years. So I left a really good impact. And the next thing you know is Pat, I went back, I took the flight back to Pensacola. And then when I got there for about a year, Vince was having Pat and Vince, they were calling me to try to get me in the territory. They wanted me to, actually for a whole year, they wanted me to come in with Rick Martel as a tag team. They wanted me to come in, and I kept telling them, no, thank you very much. I appreciate it. But no, I'm happy where I'm at. I had, and in the meantime, I'd fixed things. Dino had called me up and he said, hey, Jacques, whatever you want, you know, I'll give it to you. But come back to us. I said, okay, well, that was the point of me going for with WWF, was to just try and negotiate. And so when he gave me everything, the titles and my money that I wanted, I had my boat at the marina, I had a great life here. And so before I wanted to go and join the WWF, which I knew was a zoo there, because it was all a bunch of guys on steroids and crazy guys, and I didn't like that kind of life, so I kept telling him no, I'm refusing for about a year. And then finally, the Pat made me an offer that I couldn't refuse, you know, and I said, okay, I said, listen, I said, I'll do it at two conditions. The first condition, I said, you give me that guarantee you're saying that you're going to give me. And I said, the second reason is I want to bring my brother Raymond with me as a tag team.
Fabulous Rougeos.
So they agreed. So I said, okay. So Raymond and I went in and spent a couple of years trying to get over his baby faces. It was a little hard. Because two baby faces, French Canadians, and we didn't get the push that we wanted to. And then 2 years in the making in the WWF, 85, 86, and then 87, here comes Jimmy Hart as our manager, and we become the Fabulous Rougeau Brothers, moved to Memphis, Tennessee, not for real, but in our gimmick, and moved to Memphis, Tennessee, and went to Elvis's studio to record one of the greatest songs, All American Boys.
Yes.
That is still a great song that people play me when I go on Comic Cons. They come up to me in line and they sing my song. We don't like heavy metal. We don't like rock and roll. All we like to listen to is Barry Manilow. Hey,
yes.
We're all American. And so that song became a really big hit. So I did actually 4 years with Raymond in the WWF. Before I took a year off, and then I became the Mountie.
So, with your brother Raymond and having Jimmy Hart, how did that? Who decided that the All American Boys? That was the who? How did that gimmick come about? Was that something you and Raymond thought of? Was it Pat Patterson?
Nope,
how did that come about?
That was Vince's idea.
Vince's idea.
They asked us. Vince asked us. He brought in the office one day, and he told us. He said, "Guys, we like that you guys work and everything, but we're not getting you over as much as we'd like to as baby faces. So we'd like to give you Jimmy Hart and move to Memphis and become heels. And it would be the first time that Raymond and I would become heels and the Rougeau would become heels. So I remember telling Vince we said, well, give us 24 hours. We're going to think about it because I was thinking of my Uncle Johnny and that he'd be turning in his grave up there. Because you know the Rougeaus were always a model and first class and big baby faces in Quebec, so we knew it would impact the fans in Quebec to see us starting to cheat and lie and and do all that behind the referee's back all the time and just be no good. Anyway, no good sons of. Anyway, so all that to say that we did it well. We actually did it very well, I think, and we got so much heat. And and working with Jimmy Hart was such an amazing thing for me. Actually, that's why I asked Vince when I came back as a Mountie. That was one of my conditions to have Jimmy Hart again as my manager, because today, up till now, I speak to Jimmy once a month and I see him on the road for Comic Cons and stuff. But I have never in my 45 years in the business, I've never met a better manager than Jimmy Hart. There's not a more professional manager, and I'm not saying that because he was mine. I'm going to go ahead, and if you guys permit, I'm going to go ahead and explain to you why I'm saying this. Because Jimmy Hart, he was not only the guy that would invest in suits that have your gimmick, like he'd buy coats that would have your colors, your emblems on your coat. He'd always dress up like his proteges. And then he would create their music. He would always be on time. He would never go in bars. He never drank. He never smoked. He was like one of us. Like, you know, that we were disciplined very much. He was also the only manager, and the only manager that I've ever seen go on a promo through all his career that I've been with him, that he goes there and he doesn't start a promo like, well, let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. I know what I'm doing with these guys. I got the brains, and I got this. Jimmy Hart would never, never, never put the spotlight on him. He would never take credit for nothing. He'd always start his interviews like, hey, let me tell you something. My men right now, my men are the greatest. My men are this, and my men are that. And he always put the spotlight on his men. And then when we get to the microphone, when we start doing the interviews beside him, we feel like we were the biggest and baddest thing that ever existed, because he made us feel like that, Jimmy Hart.
He knew exactly what he was doing, and you don't have to sell us on Jimmy Hart as being Memphis people. We are, in our mind, he is the greatest manager ever. I mean, he made his name in Memphis, so we are, to say that we're Jimmy Hart fans is an understatement. That's really cool, and I've always heard that about him, that he, you know, he was such a good guy. And to your point, you go back and watch his interviews, I never really thought about it that way, but you're right. He never made it about him. You know, a lot of managers was, you know, they owned the tag team, right? These were their men that they were doing something. He came back as just a mouthpiece to let you know how incredible you guys, what his team was. His team was the stars.
So colorful and so charismatic, and also just like I said, you know, some other managers come in and let me tell you something. I got the brains and I got this. Mm-hmm. Never Jimmy would do that. Never. And that was one of the reasons why I asked him, especially such a great man, a good-hearted man. And I traveled with him for like 4 years. I traveled with Jimmy Hart. And it was so funny, because when we'd land in London, example, in the UK, well, Jimmy Hart and me, we had the same routine. Get off the plane when everybody was getting off the plane to look for places where there was nude dancing that night, or where they could find steroids, or when there's bars. Well, me and Jimmy Hart, we'd find some underground bootlegging stores, like, you know, where they have souvenirs of things that we could buy. And the next morning, you know, we'd have a flight at 7 o'clock. Well, Jimmy was at the airport at 5 o'clock, 2 hours before the flight, and we had some promos to do and anywhere we had to go to do personal meetings or personal meet and greets. And we had a 7 o'clock meet and greet. Jimmy was there at 6 o'clock. And he was just that kind of guy, and I was too. So it was fun. So that's why we were so compatible, and that's why, to me, Jim, he's an example of what you see in some sports. You see that appear. Well, Jimmy is a GOAT.
Yes.
And he could sell anything and make anything look cool. He's like, that's why we're in a duster, baby, and you're on the corner waiting for a taxi, daddy.
I think Jimmy, you know, his big thing that he doesn't, to me, he doesn't get enough credit for, and I know obviously people know this, but his musical talent and all the theme songs that he wrote, especially in the WWF, him and Jim Johnston, but he wrote so many of the classic theme songs. I mean, I think you talked about he wrote yours. He wrote Shawn Michaels' theme song. I mean, there's so many, and it's crazy to me that that's almost forgotten. You talk about what such a what a great manager he was and all the things he's brought to it. And it's like, oh yeah, he just he had some musical talent. Well, no, he was a pretty big deal in the music industry.
Well, you know, the funniest thing is you're saying this, and I'm sure you'll remember when I tell you. But and you know, of course, everybody knows he was in the Gentry.
Yes.
He was the lead singer of a real group in the 60s, I think, and 70s. I can't remember what year, but he was like on Soul Train, and he was a pop star. And but the best thing for me is, like I was telling you before, I go to Comic Cons around the world now, and then another theme song he wrote for me is I'm the Mountie.
Yes.
I'm handsome, I'm brave, I'm strong. I'm the Mountie, and I enforce the law. You could try to run, but you can never hide, because the Mountie always gets his back.
Yes.
You know what you mean? People come in line, and when it's not the All-American Boys, it's the Mountie song. And it's amazing. I saw something about a year ago that they were putting the top 10 most popular songs that ever existed for wrestling, WWF, and I had two of them in there, and they were all Jimmy Hart. So that's amazing.
You can't give
credibility enough to Jimmy for what he did.
So when you came back as the Mountie, whose idea for that gimmick? Was that yours? Was that Vince? How did that come about?
It was Vince's idea for the Mountie gimmick, but it was I had two conditions again. I always have conditions when I work with Vince. I had the two conditions. The first one is I have Jimmy Hart as my manager, and the second one is I bring my shock stick. That was my idea of the shock stick.
I was going to ask,
that's your idea of a good time?
Yeah, the cattle prod. How did that, was that something you had just thought up? Is it something you had seen somewhere else?
So let me get back to where I wanted to bring you earlier with
okay.
Coco Beware. So Coco Beware, he's my first opponent coming back as the Mountie. We're on TV.
1991 Royal Rumble.
So I got this. So I got this shock stick. That's absolutely amazing. I just had it done. It's a lawnmower coil reverse, and it's got so much power in it. It's got a flame at the end. There's some electricity going for about 2 inches wide, and you could see the big blue lines. And it was a badass. It was badass. The shock stick. And so I had this guy made it for me. So I had two buttons on it. I had one where my thumb was on top. And I had that was off and on, and I had one where my little finger was underneath. It was the emergency off and on, like you know. So when I was doing things to make sure that it was not on, I had to put both on. So when I did my first match with Coco, I was absolutely, you know, I'd been in the business a long time, but I was just absolutely so nervous, you know. So I got into the ring, and after a 15-minute match, Coco Beware is doing the job for me, so he's soaking wet. And don't ask me how it happened. I start shocking him. And when I start shocking him, he starts flipping on the mat. And I'm going like, wow, what a sell job this guy's doing for me. You know, he's pretty good. You know, and that makes my thickness really good. And next thing you know, it starts smelling like pig, you know, burnt pig skin, you know, like when you burn somebody.
Burnt flesh.
And I'm going, wow. Yes, I'm going, wow, Vince has got he's great with his gimmick, you know, make that smell like that in the ring, like, you know. And I think that it's all Vince is doing, you know. And so next thing you know, I come in the back, and I'm just so happy the way he flip-flopped like a fish there on the pavement, you know, in the ring. So I said, what a job. So I'm waiting behind the curtains to hug him, and because I knew him from Memphis from a long time ago, and so we met again in WF. So anyway, so he comes back, and when he hits the curtain, he opens the curtain and says, "You son of a bitch!" He starts screaming in front of everybody. Like, I'm going like, holy shit, what's going on? And he wanted to kick my ass so bad. And I was going like, whoa, what's going on? And I got really actually scared for a minute as he came at me like a raging bull. And I burnt him so bad. And it was like, I said, I'm sorry. I was saying, I'm sorry. I don't know what you thought. I'm sorry. He said, and I'm not going to tell you the words he was saying. I couldn't say it on the air. But he was like cussing, and he really wanted, he was right in my face, and the agents actually stopped, and he's going to beat me up. And so it was so bad because it was my first impression as a Mountie. So I'm thinking, man, you're giving a bad rep to my stick here back here. Because I can see all the boys that are on the bench saying, you ain't going to do that to me, that's for sure. You know, but Coco Beware and I, we meet now, we talk, and we laugh about it so much today. It's so much, you know, he's a good friend of mine. And actually, when you go on my Wrestling Academy website that I'll give you later in my competition here, Coco made me a nice video, you'll be able to see it. But we're really good friends now, me and Coco.
I actually talked to Coco last weekend. We've got the pleasure of becoming friends as well. And I'm gonna mention this to him sometime, get a good laugh out of Coco.
He's gonna tell you, all right.
Man, that's a great story. He you know, you're over here thinking, man, this guy's really selling for me, and then you realize, oh shit, it this thing really works. That's crazy.
No, but I didn't even realize it was on. So I thought he was just doing a great sell job, and it's only when I got backstage that I found out when he came through the curtain. So for me, he was just a great worker. Holy mackerel, what a great seller this guy is.
It was fun. Being a kid at that time, I, you know, 91, 92, I was around 10 years old, and that is, for us, that's the memory we have of you. And as I hated the Mountie. I thought he was the most evil thing in the world, that stick. Like, you sold that thing, and that was, man, you made a believer out of me.
Well, you know, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police kicked me off Canadian TV after about a year, and they banned me from TV. They took a lawsuit against WWF, and they didn't like the image I was portraying. But for me, it's one of my greatest moments, that jailhouse match I had with Big Boss.
Yes.
Man, and I ended up in jail. And it's so funny because I met Tony Khan a couple of weeks ago for the first time. He came to Montreal, AEW, and I got to speak with him for 5-6 minutes. And then what a great meeting. And the funniest thing was, these guys are not Scoopy-D. They're how do you say that? A book that knows it all? They're how do you call a book that has all the statistics and the...
Encyclopedia.
Wikipedia?
Encyclopedia.
Yeah. And not Scoopy-D, we say in French. But anyway, so all this to say is, he started telling me, so I said, I was very humble with him. I said, I know Mr. Khan. I said, Jacques Rougeau. He says, oh, how you doing, Jacques? I said, yeah, Fabio, I don't know if you know my brother Raymond Fabio. He said, of course. He says, the Mountie. He says, and how can I forget that friend of yours in jail that liked your leather suit? Because I spent the night in jail, and then there was this big gay guy that was getting close to my leather suit there. You know, he had a leather suit. And he and the words that he said, it was so funny. And then in the prison, he says, "Oh, I like the way you feel with my leather suit," you know. And I was spending the night with him, and he came up with that line. And just I was amazing that he remembered that line specifically, you know, in my angle that I did. So working with Big Boss Man is so fun. Ray Traylor, another
yeah,
one.
Yeah, please tell us about him and some memories you have. We'd love to hear about him.
Yeah, well, Ray Traylor's just a hell of a nice guy. Just so nice, so family orientated, so friendly.
One of the best big men to ever wrestle.
Didn't go out in bars, and he was always on time, always reliable. And he was one of those guys again that you just go in the ring night after night. You know, we were on the road 25 days a month in those days, and then we'd go home for 3 days and go back on the road for 25 days. And so when you'd work an angle with a guy, you'd be in every town, every city, every country, and every continent working with this guy night after night. And what a pleasure it was to work with Big Boss Man, because he was one of those guys that he took care of your body like it was his own.
Yeah.
If he'd pick you up in a way where he'd do that kind of
sidewalk
Boss Man slam.
Yeah.
And if ever one night he'd turn and his foot would get caught in the mat or something where he lost balance. Well, he made sure that you felt straight, flat on the mat, and he felt wrong to absorb the shock. So in professional wrestling, the greatest workers of all times are the ones that you give them their body, and they take care of your body before taking care of their own. And Big Boss Man was one of them.
Thank you for sharing that about the Boss Man. January 17th, 1992, you would defeat Bret the Hitman Hart for the Intercontinental Heavyweight Championship. What did this mean to you, and was it more special to you winning this from a fellow Canadian?
Well, you know, it's not really. It was just the fact that it was Brett, because Brett was iconic, and then Brett was over like $1 million. I'd worked with him for 4 years as a Hart Foundation, and now coming back to work with him again in singles. But you know, it's so funny. That's another funny thing about that Intercontinental title, because you know, that Intercontinental title, I won it on a given day in Springfield, Massachusetts, and 3 days later I lost it. I was the shortest reign, the shortest lived Intercontinental champion of all times for many, many, many years. And it's so funny, because every time I go in Comic Cons or I sign pictures everywhere around the world, they all got me with the belt. So it's almost like I think the Intercontinental belt meant a lot at that time.
It did. And it was, to fans, it was a big deal. It was a very big deal.
Very big deal.
So up till today, now 40 years later, every time I sign a picture, there I got my belt around. And then a lot of people, they make me laugh so much because they don't know what to say when they come meet me in Comic-Cons. They're a little nervous. So a lot of them come up to me and they say, "Oh, Mountie, you're the greatest Intercontinental of all times." And I'm looking at them like, "Holy shit, I only had it for 3 days. You know, I won it from Brett, and then I lost it to Rowdy Piper 3 days later."
So was that the plan? Was that the original plan, was to, some, I guess, to put Roddy and Brett in a feud, to put the belt on Roddy? Was that the plan?
No, I think the plan was that Brett didn't want to drop the belt to Rowdy.
Okay.
So they just needed an intermediate to put from Brett to Rowdy. So they used me, and that was a compliment, because to create Batman, you need a good Joker.
Yes.
And in the movie, so in the match, it's the same way. If you want to create a good baby face, you need a good heel. And I remember a story of that makes me laugh. I know you guys probably know Sid Vicious.
Yes. West Memphis, Arkansas.
And Sid Vicious, he was in the WWF, and I was a Mountie. And I remember Macho Man had quit Vince suddenly at a TV show. And so they were missing baby faces for that night. And so Vince got me in a room with Sid Vicious, and he said to Sid, he says, "Sid, we're going to turn you babyface tonight." And Sid started laughing real loud. you can't turn me babyface. I'm the hottest heel you got, you know. And then he says, "Well," he says, "we got a little idea here." So I he sent me out in the ring, and I start cutting a promo about, I'm looking at all you bunch of hillbillies out here. And I don't think there's one man in this place here that could beat the Mount. And then they all booed my butt. And then I kept going to my interaction. As a matter of fact, I said, "I just came out from the dressing room back there, and I don't think there's a man enough to beat the Maori." And by that time, the Vicious comes out with his music, and it was 20,000 people on their feet cheering for him.
Well, they always say the hottest heels or the hottest baby faces, you know, become the hottest heels and vice versa. That's how you get the most.
And I had just turned him in on a dime.
Yeah.
From being the hottest to the hottest baby face. So I was very proud that and that they used me for that, because, you know, it's a position where you don't forget things like that, because you need to be in a position to make that happen. If you take a heel that has no heat, it's not going to work. So that was a great compliment to me when Vince did that to Sid Vicious.
And speaking of greatness, you were the Intercontinental Champion. Doesn't matter how long you were an Intercontinental Champion. Then you would hook up with Pierre, and y'all would become the Quebecers and be three-time WWF Tag Team Champs. What was it like working with Pierre as the Quebecers?
It was awesome. I guess they were lacking of tag teams there to put us champions anyway. But long story short is, yep, for three times we became Tag Team Champions and beat the Steiner Brothers on the first night in. Actually, in New York, the first night we appeared, we beat the Steiners, Quebec rules. And then after that, we beat the 1-2-3 Kid, Marty Jannetty, lost it with them and gained them back. And then Men on a Mission, we did an angle with them and lost it and gained it back. So we had it for about a year, off and on, and most of the time we had it. So I was lucky, you know. I was lucky to have that position when the... And we also, Raymond and I, you know, something that people don't know that, but to talk about the screw job in Montreal, but with Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart, that's not the real screw job in Montreal. that's the real screw job in Montreal, is that Raymond and I, we beat the Hart Foundation for the tag team titles. And people don't know that when we were baby faces in 1987, before we turned heel. And 3 days later in the newspaper, they put a little ad to saying, oh, because the referee wasn't at the right place or this or that, finally the Hearts are still champions. But that night, it was like 20,000 people that thought they won the Stanley Cup in Montreal, or like in hockey, and 5,000 people were waiting for me at the back, banging on my car of joy and happiness, when my wife at the time, she was, excuse my expression, she was shitting in their pants, thought that they wanted to beat us up, but they were just cheering like they won the Stanley Cup, and then all the people that were there, and the media, the TV stations that talked about it the next day, that the Rougeau brothers are world tag team champions. Then they showed up on TV the next Saturday to watch the Rougeau tag team champions, and the Hearts had the belts on, and they were talking about the Rockers that were defending the belts. And it was like, so people really, really, really were upset with that in Montreal, because, you know, Bret Hart comes from the West, but the right. Rougeaus are from Montreal. And then, so it was like screwing the Jerry Lawler in Memphis, like, yes. You know, over something like that, you know. So that was the biggest screw job Montreal has ever seen, I think.
Well, when you and Raymond were heels in the WWF, and when you were heels, the Mountie, and with the Quebecers, did you tour, or did you have any shows in Montreal? And if you did, how did the fans react to you as you being a heel here? Did they somehow cheer you? Were you a babyface once you got to Montreal because of your history?
Yeah, I think you need to ask that to Billy Gunn, Billy and Bart Gunn. Billy and Bart Gunn, they came with their pistols and their cowboy suits, and they came
smoking
in their
guns.
Babyface in Montreal. Yeah, but there was no more smoking their guns by the time they finished the match. they were booed so bad, you know, in Montreal. You couldn't touch the Rougeaus, even as heels. You know, Raymond and I, they knew at that time that we had that we were playing the game, that we were just playing roles, but we were still the heroes because we made it to the big leagues, the World League. So we were people who always liked us anyway, and it was hard to be a heel here in Montreal. Yeah, very hard.
Speaking of Montreal, I'm gonna fast forward. Speaking of Montreal, 1997, WCW World Championship Wrestling. You're one of a few people in the business to cleanly beat Hulk Hogan. How did that come about?
It was just absolutely amazing. There was a clean pin also, no gimmicks, no chairs, no tables, just a small package, 1, 2, 3. And that came about for a couple of reasons, I think. Hulk and I were pretty good friends, and we became friends actually when I, the day that I, well, first of all, every show that Hulk had, Raymond and I, from the start, we always went in and worked so hard. We were always professionals, always on time at the airport, always clean and nice clothes, and always signing autographs, being nice to everybody, very professional. We had an ethic that was very, very, and Hulk liked that because Hulk was the same way. Anybody who'd come to see Hulk at 5 o'clock in the morning at the airport and asking for an autograph, he'd always say yes. He would never say no. He was so professional. And then we were the same, and I think he took a liking in that very much. And then when we started working for him, doing shows and just performing like we were doing, and many times, you know, in our business, a lot of people think the main event is the most important match of the night, when so many times we opened the show for them on the road on our Hulk's night, that happens that we weren't first match. And Hulk understood that the first match is the most important match of the evening, not the last one. The
yes.
first one, because it's either there you insult the intelligence of the people or you get them to get on board.
One sets the tone.
And
Raymond and I, we always did such a hell of a job that Hulk loved it. Every time, and he told us that, every time you guys start a show, man, the show goes so good after that. Like, you know, the show goes, and then there was a, that was one of the reasons, I think. He wanted to give me credit back to the Rougeau family. I think I'm the one who pinned him, but I also think he was giving it to the Rougeaus, not only to me, that win. And the other reason, I honestly think it's because that I stood up to the British Bulldog from bullying in the WWF, and And everybody knows the story that that Dynamite was a big bully, and he hurt a lot of people, and he broke a lot of careers in the business. And when he attacked me in the dressing room, and then I did a comeback on him a week later, and then not because I'm a fighter, because I'm far from being a fighter. I just wanted to save the image of the Russo family, and so I gave him a receipt, what you call in the business, and the bullying stopped. The bullying stopped after that. It was finished, and I stopped an era of bullying in the WWF where there were so many guys that came to see me once they quit the business. 2 weeks later, they completely quit the Bulldogs. People coming to see me, guys like Terry Taylor, guys that everybody come and see me and say, and that slap me on my butt and say, Jacques, you know, you did something that I wanted to do for so long, you know, that didn't want to do, and a lot of careers were ruined because of him. I'm thinking about Back Jack. I'm thinking of Honky Tonk Man too. He had some problems. One night, I heard he was on his knees crying in the dressing room from the Dynamite Kid. So he was a big bully. So when I knocked his teeth out, and I think that I even think that even though they never touched Hulk and they never ribbed Hulk because he was the main source of the income, I think that Hulk personally, this is my personal thoughts, but I think that Hulk was afraid that he would become a victim also eventually, and so when I got rid of that. Then I think from that day on, because everybody knew I wasn't a fighter. I'm just an entertainer. I'm an artiste. And
you got a boombox and a duster.
So to do what I did, excuse my expression, but it took so much big balls because I don't have them. I normally don't have them in life, and it was like what a situation. It was so horrible. And the week before I did my comeback, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I was throwing up every time I'd eat. I was so afraid that I'd miss my shot or that he'd beat me up again, you know. And so it took a lot to do what I did, and I think that Hulk appreciated that. So, and that happened not long after that we met in Montreal again, and I think that influenced him to, it's almost like saying the thank you, I think, somewhere.
Yeah, it showed your peers that you know, they earned your respect, that you would stand up to a bully and handle business. And that it goes without saying that they, you know, they looked at you with admiration.
And Jacques, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it's funny how life is, because after that, you know, when I quit the business in WWF for 30 years that followed that, I've been up till today now still. I'm in schools giving conferences to kids, 600-800 kids in schools about bullying and how to beat bullying without using violence. And I'm now a spokesman in Canada on the bullying day, and it opened so many doors, and it made me, it makes me feel so good to know that I've helped for 30 years the kids beat bullying in their schools, and so I'm recognized for that now. And it never would have happened if I didn't get beat up by the Bulldog. So it's funny how things work out sometimes.
Thank you for sharing that. We definitely appreciate you for doing that. Before we wrap this thing up, talk to us about what you have going on now, your wrestling academy, your wrestling contest. Tell everybody about all that.
Well, you know, it's just about the greatest competition on the globe right now around the planet. And I'm being very humble about it, but I'm being very honest. You know, 45 years in the business, I know my business. And if you go on my website, which is wrestling-academy.ca, so wrestling-academy.ca, you could go on YouTube. You could also see the finals of this year. The shows are all on YouTube. Go see Jacques Rougeau's Wrestling Academy. And it's just amazing. I started this thing with my girlfriend 2 years ago because I have a passion for wrestling. I never lost it. And so we recruit all the wrestlers from Canada, from Prince Edouard, from New Brunswick, on the East Coast, all the way to Vancouver and the West Coast, Calgary, Edmonton, everywhere, in the plains, in the prairies, in Manitoba, Saskatoon, and everywhere. We get the best wrestlers of indie wrestling, like, you know, all local promoters that have their best talent, and we recruit them. We fly them into Montreal. We get them hotels, and then we have them meet each other. I go on Zoom with them, and I a lot of them don't know each other because East Coast, West Coast, and stuff like that. So I get on Zoom with them, and then I put a match together with them. And then we get at the Club Soda in Montreal. Well, this year we upgraded to the Leonardo da Vinci, like the painter there, Leonardo da Vinci. It's a class place. It's a beautiful place. We upgraded this year. It's going to be amazing. It's our third year. So I get with them on Zoom, and then I put a match together with them, like, you know, over the phone, 3 weeks, a month before their match that they go live in Montreal. And then when they come in, we put all our ideas together. The talent gives me their ideas. I give them my ideas. And then we put this mess together, and then we get at the competition here. There's four competitions in Montreal every year, two quarterfinals, one semifinals, and one final. And the winners, they get, there's four winners of $10,000 each, two men and two women. And the fun thing about it is they start with the quarterfinals, they get in the ring, and they do their match. And after the match, they stand in the middle of the ring, and then we got judges by the ring. I had my brother Raymond this year, QT Marshall from the Nightmare Factory, and we're going to have Hodes. We're going to have Jimmy Hart this year coming, Double J, Jeff Jarrett's going to come this year. And we have them sitting by the ring, and we look at the match, and then they judge on four things, on the way they're dressed, their ability in the ring, their charisma, their promo they do before their match. And we just look at them, and whoever shines that night best, because when I do it on Zoom, I make sure that they both look good. But on that given night, because you guys know how wrestling is, the same match we could have with guys for 25 nights, sometimes you have good nights, sometimes you have bad nights, and sometimes you have a hell of a night. And so it just so happens how it comes out that night at the competition. So they're judged on all those critics, and whoever the judges think are passing to the next round, or they go to the semifinals, and then they go to the finals, and then at the very end, there's four that are chosen, and they win $10,000, which these guys and girls are used to winning, making $100 a night, you know, in the independent circuit. So for them, and it's great visibility. I do podcasts around the world with this. I do them in Australia and Europe, so I give them great visibility in the States. And for them, it's an experience to meet a lot of promoters across Canada that they didn't know before. The talent's getting a great visibility, and my girlfriend and I were just having a blast with this, just putting this competition together.
Awesome.
All wrestlers and fans, please check that out.
You say the website one more time. It's wrestling-academy.
Wrestling-academy.ca. And if you have a pen and if you have a pen and paper, I'll give it to you in French in case it doesn't come out in English. It's lutteacademy.ca. So lutte is LUTTE.
Okay.
And then Academy is ACADEMIE.
Okay.
Contrary to English, .ca. And if you want to go check that competition out for the last 2 years, and the funniest thing about that is if you go on the website, lutteacademy.ca, wrestlingacademy.ca, you will see, if you go down the website, you will see all my friends. I mean, they all put in good words there for the academy, for the wrestlers up in Canada. You have they're all putting a little good word in there, wishing them good luck. And I mean some good people there. I'm talking about Hacksaw, Coco's there, Double J's there. You got Undertaker, you got Brett, you got Jerks, GSP. You got different disciplines, hockey players. You got different disciplines of people putting in there. I can't go down the list of the boys that you'll see. Ronnie Garvin, Ricky Steamboat. They're all there. You just go and you click on the picture, and then you'll see the video starts playing. So it's just an amazing website, and you will see all the participants of this year. And it's starting, so funny that you say that, because tomorrow morning on my Facebook, Saturday morning on my Facebook, if anybody wants to go see my Facebook, it's public. So you'll see a picture of me and my girlfriend, Jacques Rougeau. And starting on Saturday morning, we're going to put the promo of all the new contestants for 2024, all the talent that's coming to Montreal in 2024, the four winners of $10,000 and all that stuff. In 2 days, it's going to be announced, and it's only starting in August. But it's a 530-seated place. It's a first-class place. It's a place where, let's say, Tom Jones would go sing into it. It's a nice place. It's not the... It's chairs that all have big cushions. It's almost like a big theater. It's Bocelli would go sing in a place like that in Montreal. So we upgraded to from a place that was like in a bar that we used to do it at the Club Soda, and now we're at Leonardo da Vinci, which is and we got producers, TV producers that are looking at our show now, and they want to join us for next year. That's a big possibility. So many things are happening with this wrestling academy, so it's a great success story. But most importantly of all is I'm living my passion still after all these years in wrestling.
Well, awesome. Well, speaking of that, we're getting to live our passion and our dreams and everything like that too. So, Jacques, I can't thank you enough for doing this show, and what a huge honor. And I thank you for being a guest and for your awesome stories. And it's been our pleasure, sir.
Yeah, thank you for taking time to share with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And you know, please send me the link once this goes on the air, because I like to put that on my Facebook.
We will, and we will. And we will also add a link of your links as well to our page when we release the show, so that fans, when they click on ours, will also be able to click on your wrestling page as well, on your website.
Well, that's awesome. And you know what? And thank you. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to send you the video that's coming out in 2 days. I'll send it to you. So if you want to link it out for the people who want to go see the new contestants, you'll see there's great talent in Canada that are just last thing I'll tell you is, my father told me when I started in the business, there's two ways to make it in wrestling. There's two criteria. The first one is being at the right place at the right time, and the other one is knowing the right people.
Yep.
And this is what Wrestling Academy is doing for all the Canadian talent from East Coast to West Coast. So thank you guys for sharing that and giving the visibility to all the Canadian talent that are as good as the American talent and the big talent that are on TV. They come from somewhere, and believe it, a lot of them, one day you'll see on my academy that they'll be big stars.
Feel free to tag me in any post, send me that link, and I'll make sure you get out there, Jacques. I'll do anything I can to help you promote, you know, whatever you got going on, because I'm very honored that you would do this with us, and I so appreciate you.
So you guys... I'll finish by saying, when I was in Nashville, when about 40 some years ago, I was at the restaurant and I told the lady that was sitting beside me, I said, y'all put ketchup on your eggs?
A little bit.
No, we put grits.
We put grits. Oh, absolutely. I love your southern accent, Jacques. That's much better than my French Canadian.
Call the police. I'm going to call the police.
The police. Your southern accent is much better than my French Canadian, that's for sure.
Oh, boy, I tell you, when I came back to Montreal, I was a hit. I used to talk like that. And I used to have my CB. Oh, yeah, my famous car that you'll remember there. I used to have a CB in there. And I used
CB
to
radio.
All the shit.
CB radio, right with the Duke's hat.
Bring it one by.
Yes.
You got a bear there. You got a bear at the mile marker, 24 there. Keep your eyes open.
Yes.
We got Jacques Rougeau in Memphis, Tennessee, and he's eastbound and down.
Yeah, that's right. Smokey's on his trail, baby.
We're going to wrap this thing up. Thank you. Thank you so much, Jacques. It's been a huge pleasure and honor.
Been truly an honor, sir. Thank you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Bye-bye.